if I tell stupid stories about, if I make a stupid story that's pertinent to something that I might test you on, it's amazing how much people remember this stuff. So, but if I just sort of say it, so I have to have stories about everything, I guess, at least amusing to me. All right, so we've talked about selection issues, and I've emphasized the fact that we have to make sure that it's a reliable test, in other words, consistent, that we get the same scores, and then we can look at the validity of the test to see whether it's predictive of future job performance. And, of course, the higher the validity, the stronger the correlation, and therefore the stronger prediction between test score of whatever it is and future job performance. And you can see that the increased validity of a selection test is going to help you because you'll hire people that are going to be the best at the job rather than somebody who just might be so-so. So validity is important, and we're trying to keep that as high as possible, and we should continue to monitor as best as possible the validity of our tests as we continue to use them. We should not assume that they are, even if they're reliable initially, we should keep an eye on them and see how they work out and do maybe concurrent validation follow-ups in the years ahead, even though the courts won't take them. So that's the concept of selection, at least as far as I need to talk about it. We talked about some of the tests, and I encouraged you to make sure that if a test looks like it's dumped, like the Rorschach inkblot test, the TAT, and a few others, to look at those with a jaundiced eye and instead try tests that have been made up for you by a publishing group or a psychologist or whatever that might seem to be, and then try it out, appropriate. You don't have to come up with these tests yourself. You can buy paper and pencil tests for almost any job. So you might want to look at those as well. They've already been validated as being a useful tool for future job performance. Okay, so now you've got these new employees with you in the organization, and so we have to figure out... Give me a pair of scissors. Got it. So now that we have this new employee enter the organization here, there's the new employee, right, coming to work. And as they come into your organization, we are at the point of at which the employee is the most vulnerable to becoming an ex-employee. Right? At this point, the loss rate is pretty high. So we want to, as much as possible, eliminate this loss thing. People balk. They get the offer, and then they balk either right away. They just have second thoughts about it, like they go to buy a car, and they buy it, and then they start to feel bad about it, or whatever. These ideas of second-guessing yourself. Or the company fails to incorporate the employee into the process. So I want to talk a little bit about this idea of orientation. Orientation to the new organization. For just a minute, I'm not going to beat this too much. You all know about orientation and how important it is to try and understand the employee and help them fit into this organization. Orientation has been seen to be extremely cost-effective in terms of holding on to employees that you've already spent a fair amount of time and money selecting. So at this point, if that employee walks out on you after you've offered them the job, this is a dead loss to you. You've lost a good employee, and you spend a fair amount of money hiring this employee. So from that point, we want to, as much as possible, hold on to that employee. And the way that this has been seen to be most effectively done is to use an orientation process, which essentially helps the employee feel good about the people that they're going to be working with and understand the organization and reinforce the value of being with this organization, and show them, as much as possible, the nuts and bolts of living within the organization. You know, where's the bathroom? Where's your workstation? What are you going to be doing? Who's your supervisor, et cetera. So as much as possible, you try to bring the person into the organization. And it just crossed my mind that for you guys, the idea of social networking could be incorporated into this orientation process, right? So it's something I hadn't thought about before, being not too high on the social networking. So this idea here might play into what you guys are good at now, you know, exchanging ideas across the internet. So what we're looking at here is to essentially bring the person in. So they could have a mentor, right? Part of this could be mentoring. Mentoring with somebody that shows them the ropes of how to be within the organization. And that mentor could be another employee doing the same kind of work, and they could therefore incorporate them into the organization fairly easily and quickly. And I would encourage you to keep this in mind. Don't assume that you can just take an employee and push them into an organization as the employee will be comfortable. Some employees will, and some employees definitely won't. And so you would want to be careful about that since you have invested a fair amount in this employee or this new hire already. Okay, so we go forward from orientation now to the idea of training. So, the idea of training, sometimes known as development, and sometimes known as a separate entity, so we have training and development, but I'm just going to use the term training. What is the difference, by the way, would you say, between training and developing, in terms of what they mean?
I would say training is initial and developing is like an ongoing process.
If one involves the brain and one involves the hands, which one are the two?
Development involves the brain.
Right, and like training would be the hands. And so development would really be in more of an ongoing process, particularly if you want to hold on to that employee and you're working with them to become more skilled at what they're doing or to take on skills that will be with them or will be needed for them in their new job in a different position. So development is this sort of ongoing, mostly oriented toward mental development, and training is more hands-on. So what do we see now in terms of development now, of course, is you know, making sure that a person is completely familiar with use of various software packages, the internet, social media, those kinds of things. And this would be more of sort of whatever hands-on might happen to be. And this is more maybe mental changes, hands-on changes, if I had to say. But I'm going to refer to it the whole mess under the rubric of training, the title of training. Well, let's see. There has been a lot done in the training area, and a lot of it has been taken out of the educational literature. How do we educate people? And there's an overlap between this idea of education and training and development. So a lot of the literature and the research on this has come out of teaching students. But if we're going to look at this and go forward with this, I'd say that the training process has changed substantially over the years. Back in the early 1800s, late 1700s, how were people trained for their jobs in many of these little villages that were so isolated?
Apprenticeships.
The apprenticeship was the training process. Talk about hands-on, right? And the master would train the apprentice over a period of perhaps 6-7 years so that the person became a master at doing that type of work. So that would be sort of 1700s, let's say. Then we move to the 1800s, and we're talking about the Industrial Revolution, and what's the training here? Pardon? Right, here's the machine you're going to be working, and here's the handle you pull. draining over. Okay, so this was, you know, mechanized. Okay, so then we move to the 1900s and into the late, let's just say, 1960s plus. And what happens here? What are we beginning to see? Changing of our jobs from what to what, starting at about this time. Our jobs, in large part, were what during the 30s, 40s, and 50s, and 60s? What were we doing?
Manufacturing.
So we had tons of manufacturing. And then, as you all learned from your econ courses, we came into a situation of specialization. So we moved out of manufacturing and into service industry stuff. And in service industry stuff, you don't just stand in front of a machine and pull a lever. You're dealing with the public, right? You're interacting with people. So there's a lot more, when it comes to training, there's a lot more of this developmental skills of how to interact with people in situations. And people, of course, are certainly random quantities. And when they come and talk to you, and you're a service person, even if you're a doctor or a surgeon or a college professor or whatever it is, you have to have some, believe it or not, people skills. And that's a developmental process. And so this change over the years has changed the way in which we train people in large part. So it's much less now sort of a hands-on training, which we'll go through and I'll talk to you about, but now it's much more the idea of developing people's capacities to be service-oriented. I'll ask these as a provocative question. Are you raised as a child from the time you're born, let's say, up until you go through school and perhaps you go to college? What's been the focus of, let me see how I can say this. What have you been trained to do up until the time you're, say, 20?
Make good grades.
Make good grades, which is focused on yourself. What else?
Obey authority.
Yeah, I think in large part that's true. Yes, and what is the proper interaction with people? Somebody, I was just talking to somebody, a student, about this the other day. I was reading an article about it in the paper. That students now, you guys are two, T-O-O, what's the word I want to put in here?
With. Politically correct.
This article was about too polite. Too polite, too nice, and too sort of laissez-faire in terms of what allowing other people to do what they want to do. So my point is here that as you grow up, you've been trained, at least from what this article was saying, to focus on stuff that you're supposed to do in order to be accessible. And this is open, certainly open to be discussed, because I'm not even a kid anymore, and I can barely remember it. I think I might have been born at around 35. I can't remember.
Well, that largely like a more cultural thing, too.
Say again?
And then more like a largely cultural thing, too.
It is a largely cultural thing, and where do you get the culture as you get older and you get tossed out into the world? Because before that, it's the culture of your family, right? And you learn how to get along with your parents. You learn how to appease your parents when you smash up the front end of the car, et cetera, et cetera. I've already told you this, didn't I, that my mother smashed my car up.
Your minivan?
Pardon?
Your minivan?
Did I what?
Your minivan?
No, my Porsche. I had a Porsche convertible, and my mother smashed it up. The dirty dog.
Did she get you another one?
They took it and had it fixed. Jesus. Anyway, there it is, brand new and shiny. It was like about 5 days old, and she said, I'm gonna drive it over to do some shopping. I said, fine. It was like the weekend, and then she comes back and says, Jerry, I got something to show you. She pulled too far out into the intersection. She's pulling out into the intersection. Here comes a guy making a corner like this and just took the front end off the car.
She wasn't even crying when she told you?
My mother came from a family where you didn't sweat the small stuff. Things like car accidents, whatever, you know.
I don't know if getting a car, I mean, a bush
basically. Whatever, you know. So, anyway, it was one of, how did I get onto this topic? Being polite, being sort of culturally adjusted by your family to what it is, now you go out into the world and you have a completely different focus. The camera is no longer on. Who?
You.
You? Who's it on?
You're trying to please everybody.
You're in a service setting, most likely, be it at a bank or insurance company or whatever. Your focus is now to be hypersensitive to what the customers want, up to a point. And this is where the too polite came in. Up to a point. When the company starts, and this is a new area of research, how customer-oriented should businesses be? They should be customer-oriented, the customer's always right, up to a point where they're now wrong. Right?
Yeah.
Which is when it's just out of the question and it's just too expensive for the company to have to deal with making sure these customers are okay. So there's a limit on where you're going to allow customers to have slack. Right? So it's an orientation change.
And the 60s moved us into this much more of a service training situation. How do you get along with people?
How do you make customers want to come back, et cetera? So the other day, my wife's on elliptical machine, on the elliptical machine, and there's this crash from down in the gearbox somewhere. She said, "Jerry, fix this. I need to use it." That's her immediate response. Fix it, I need to use it.
Oh, okay.
So I get the whole thing apart, and it's got this broken arm, and it's got an arm that runs a flywheel, blah, 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 blah. So I get the whole damn thing apart, and here's this thing with like a shattered knuckle on the end where these two things are supposed to connect. I call up the company, I say, you know, here we are with this, whatever they cost, or something, I forget now, it's had 5 years. What's the deal? He says, well, your warranty's out. I said, well, no, it shouldn't break. And he said, well, it just happens over time. You know, you probably should have it serviced. You don't have to blame on me. You should have it serviced every couple of years, et cetera, et cetera, and we're not paying for it. I said, all right, well, send me the part instead. So they sent me the part, $16. Now, back in the old days, what would have happened? Just maybe 15 or 20 years ago. I think they would have sent it to me. I think they would have said, well, we want the customer to be always happy. But now there's a little less of that. There's a sort of a limit, except that there's now a limiting on the limit, which is what? Social media.
Mm-hmm.
So this is an interesting, because people complain, right? Oh, I had this thing for 5 years and the knuckle broke out on the drive. And now I have to pay $16 to get it and do the work to fix it myself. I'm not hiring some guy to come up and twist the same wrench as I could twist.
In 2005, when they made the third generation 4Runner,
okay,
they put brake pumps on it, and like at 100,000 miles, all the brake pumps just go out. Like, just silent comes on your car. Like,
I gotta hear that.
Basically, essentially, some people like were driving, and all of a sudden their brake would just go straight down to the floor, and they wouldn't have any brake.
This is true, really. You're not making this up.
I swear, because at my car, like, the brake light came on and stuff when we went to the guy at the Toyota dealership, that's what he told us. But according to them, it wasn't enough people for them to do a recall on it. So now they charge you $1,000 to get this brake pump replaced.
Oh, great.
But it's like, they knew when they put it on there that this was going to happen.
On my Toyota van, same type of deal. The door starts to clank. It's got like 20,000 miles on it. You push the door open, it goes, ga-bam! You pull it closed, ga-bam! Right? So I took it over, and they said, okay, we'll fix it for you. They fixed it, and it was fine for about 10,000 miles. And then it started doing the bam, ga-bam again. I said, there's a recall on this. I called Toyota. I said, I understand there's a recall. It's gone out again. The guy said, there's never any recall on this. They just did it because they were being nice to you, but now they're not going to do it to be nice to you.
And then they didn't pay it.
Well, I didn't pay them. I fixed it myself. So, you know, so now it seems to be okay. I've only had it about 5,000 miles with my repair, which involves sheet metal screws all the way around the thing that was loose. The thing is peppered with sheet metal screws. We'll see. It may hold up, but it may not. The weld didn't hold, but maybe the sheet metal screws will. Who knows? That poor
I think they just break the car more than ticket dealership. Because it comes home with more problems when I take it there that I didn't have before.
What is it?
Well, at least in my experience of my mom's car, or my family's experience, like, we come home and suddenly there'd be a computer problem with her Volvo, and it cost $2,000 to fix. That
don't get me started on Volvos.
I always had them, but now I'm sworn off of those babies.
I don't blame you.
It's, I mean, just to keep the warning light bulbs in place is an expense. New light bulbs, they always are on and always burning out. Put them in. Yeah, it's an expensive car to run, in my opinion. I've had probably six of them.
You got Toyota instead now.
There you go.
I don't blame you.
There you go. All right, so my point is here that this whole idea of how a person has been trained over the years has changed. And we'll talk about sort of a general example here. And the general example comes a lot from the educational literature, and I'll try and sort of generalize it into a service situation as well. But basically, I'll just say here, training. I'll put in parentheses here, what are the general times when you need training, would you say? Give me some examples.
New employee.
A new employee, right. If they're low. If new EE is low on scores, whatever the job happens to be. What else?
New process.
New technology process, right? Go up another level. What above this? When the foreman sees that unit levels are low, let's say. They're not putting out as much as they used to, and something's changed, right? So I just say low output numbers. So that's just some. There's other examples, too, but that's at least some. If the employee is low, we're going to train them. If the whole unit, so low output unit numbers on some part of it, etc. All these might be a training. So I'll say a training session. And in general, the literature seems to want you to first create value, which means you talk to the trainees about what they're going to get out of it. You know, it's, what's the deal? Why are you here? We know what we're going to get out of it as a company. We're going to get you working faster so that we get more production out of you, whatever it is. Working with customers, putting widgets onto something, whatever it might happen to be, the training will do it so it's more profitable to us. That's certainly why we're doing it. We're spending money on training because it's cost beneficial to us. But what's in it for the employee? So we're going to create value here by telling the employees, you know, telling EEs what they get. And they could get things like incentive pay, more incentive pay, promotional opportunities, whatever it happens to be. At a better level job, they might get some stock options as a reward. Who knows? Any number of possible things can be generated from employees' improved behavior. So the training then here in this situation is focused on what the employee is going to get if they're successful through the training and it carries on into the work that they're doing. Okay? What they get. And that could be, you know, money, comma, promotion. I'll just put ETC, etc. If you don't put the motivation in place, what's going to happen? Come on, take a wild guess. They won't take the training seriously. They won't put their hearts into it. They'll just be thinking about how they're going to get off for fall break. Oh, sorry. How they're going to get off for the upcoming weekend
and the big game with the Eagles winning yet another one, smashing the opponents into the ground and running them over their cleats and crushing them on their way to the Super Bowl. Yeah, what a picture. Isn't it a wonderful picture? Boy, did they kill the Giants. That was an unpleasant game for the people in New York, I think. Wonderful for Philadelphia.
Dude, I need y'all to beat Dallas.
Huh? I hate Dallas. Yeah, thank you. You're a man after my own heart. All right. It's the team everyone loves to hate. That's me. What do they get, et cetera, et cetera. So we build this motivation to start with. Because as you all know, performance is a function of what two, at least, components of the individual. You must have had this in OB class.
Self-esteem.
Screw self-esteem. I don't care about that.
Motivation.
Motivation is one of them. And what's the other? They have to have at least motivation plus what to get something done?
Ability.
Yeah, I guess so. Performance, function of ability and motivation. So that's a good thing. Are you thinking about a tattoo this weekend? Going over and getting a tattoo? I would suggest that on your arm. You got job analysis, cornerstone of human resource management right there, right? Underneath that, put performance as a function of ability and motivation. Okay, I'm just helping you out, you know, fit in with your friends. You got to have tattoos, right, stuff like that. Just an idea. Okay, so what does this part of it mean? Ability and motivation. What's this little stinking X in there? I think they're all leaving. At quarter of three. What's the X mean here? X Factor, a good TV show. No, doesn't mean that. X marks the spot where the treasure is. No, it doesn't mean that. What's the damn X mean?
You have some level of either way.
So it's a multiplying sign because you have to have some level of both. If any one of these goes to zero, what's the performance? Zero, right? When my Chicago Marathon son was really little, he wanted to drive. Oh, let me drive. After a while, he's like a year and a half or two, right? Let me drive. So you put him on your lap. How much skill does he have?
Zero
skill. But he's got tons of motivation. So you put him on the lap, and he holds the wheel. And, of course, it's like playing spider. Did you ever play spider when you were kids? Hey, you are kids. One guy drives, another guy steers, another guy's lying on the floor working the brake, another guy's working the accelerator. That's called spider. Okay. Anyway, so this is sort of like mini spider. You got the kid on the lap. He's holding the steering wheel. You're pressing the gas and working the brake and sort of surreptitiously steering it down here. All the neighbors have moved their cars off the street, and you're going down the street. Let me drive. You're driving. Let me drive. And then he goes down the street. So my point is here, lots of motivation, no skill. And so the performance would have been zero if I hadn't been. Sorry. Okay, so this should remain constantly on your arm and in your mind in terms of things that we need to think about with our employees. Ability is what we're thinking about training for, but we have to put in place some motivation. What's in it for me? Right. So we're going to put these two things together through this motivation, what's in it for you, blah, 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 plus the training here on how to do it, how to do the job or some component of the job. So that's sort of the background of this. Okay, so here's what training tells us to do. The training, generally speaking, should be very simplistically explained. Task and level to achieve. Which is to say, set goals for them to achieve, right? So explain the task and levels of performance to achieve. Goal setting. Do you remember goal setting from an OB class? Difficult but obtainable goals, right?
Is that Lawler? I think it's Lawler, University of Maryland, right, did all this research, I believe. Okay, so we explain the task, what we want them to achieve. We could then demonstrate it here. Demonstrate the task. The demonstration allows the employee to see what it has to be done. It could be cold calling, it could be running something on the internet, it could be anything, whatever. But we're going to demonstrate that particular task and then demonstrate it again a few times so they can see exactly how something should be done. Then, okay, just do it, exclamation point. Now the employee gets to do this and practice doing it, making phone calls, writing things for social media, tweets, is that right? Tweets? When you put things on that, is it a tweet?
Yeah.
You put a tweet on Twitter?
Yeah.
Okay, practicing how to write and post on Twitter, right? Something like that. Whatever. It could be anything. So the idea here is they do it. They practice it. And, of course, the trainer is watching to see how they're doing and providing feedback. The feedback, as you can imagine, is going to be focused on improving, right? But if you do it wrong, it's going to be demotivational. You moron. Any idiot could have done this. My 2-year-old came in and did a great job with this, and here you are struggling, right, et cetera. That's not going to be motivational. So what you're looking at here is to create a motivational feedback situation, which is, well, as we used to call it, the, I won't say it quite that way, I'll say the mud sandwich, okay? It's the mud sandwich. You got bread, which is compliments, then you got the bad part, that's the mud in the middle, and then you got the more bread at the end to make it more palatable for them to swallow this information. So what we have is good, bad, and good in terms of feedback, right? This then becomes the feedback process. This is what we need to concentrate on, but we don't want to just present it as you're doing something bad. We need to present it surrounded by goodness. And that's this feedback. This is an, as we say, iterative, in other words, repetitive loop, an iterative loop. Just goes round and around until goal is achieved. Goal for training is A-C-H-I-E-V-E, exclamation point. The goal for the training is achieved.
The second one they do that, demonstrate?
Yeah, demonstrate. Demonstrate, do it, feedback, do it, well, demonstrate, feedback, do it, around and around and around until eventually they drop down to having achieved the goal that we set for them up here.
That's the goal setting process?
Yeah. Difficult but achievable goals.
Edwin Locke.
All right, so this process is a traditional training situation. A couple other factors here. If you're going to be doing any kind of training, make sure that at least a person starts into it in a positive frame of mind. Here's two scenarios. One is the training will take place on Saturdays with no pay. We start off at 6 o'clock in the morning, bring your own brown bag lunch, and it's going to be in the basement of YMCA, and then you'll be finishing up around 5. How's that for motivational? It starts off with bites. right? It's not good. People are not going to be motivated to do this. On the other hand, if we say the training session is going to take place in Hawaii, we'll be there for 10 days, you have classes from 10 o'clock to lunchtime, and the rest of the day and in the morning, it's on your own, how's the motivation going to be there? Hunky freaking dory, right? Sounds good to me. So we want to put together a setting that works, right, and doesn't predispose an individual to hate it, right? I don't want to be in the basement, it's going to be why, right? I want to be outside playing with my kids, teaching them how to drive, etc. So put in place a good environment here for learning. A couple other points here, which will just take a minute before I cut it off, and then we'll finish our more important components next week of this. Here we have established the number that we want. At that point, the person might return to their job. Has the training been successful? In this class, the best answer is it depends. Right. No matter what, I may have mentioned to you before, in our discussion about diapers or something. Is that whatever. All right, so what would it depend on? Is this person going to be successful on the job? It depends. Depends on what?
Their level of motivation.
Well, the motivation and the performance that they take back with them to the job, right? What happens if they got to the requisite number of units here, the required unit output or the required sales outcome or whatever, and then they go back to the job and they fall back to their old habits? There's no transference, is the term. There's no transference between the artificiality of this formal learning. This would be considered formal learning, classroom learning, like this is formal. So we have a formal learning process here. There's no transference from the formal learning to the job. That'd be one reason why I'd be failing. So these are reasons for fail. Is the company happy now? Not necessarily, because it depends on what else? How about if the person now becomes such a stellar employee that they say, God, I could have never gotten that job over at Acme Widget with my background as it was, but now I'm a newly trained, highly specialized individual, and they take off to Acme Widget, right? What happens to all your training money that you've spent? Right, down the proverbial rat hole, exactly. No use to you at all anymore, because the money is now gone. In fact, it's detrimental, because your competitor now has the well-trained employee that you spent all this time with. Right. Okay, if we take care of all that stuff, is the training been successful? Go ahead, all together, say it.
It depends.
It depends, right, on how long it stays at that high level. If they taper off after a couple days because there's group pressure for them to slow down, or they're more interested in watching the Eagles play on their pocket phone, or whatever it might happen to be, which is a pretty good reason. It could be lots of things that still cause an employee to slow down, and their output is essentially back to normal. So you've wasted that money. Okay. So my point is here that just looking, going through this and getting a person up to their number doesn't necessarily mean that they're doing well. And please don't ever tell me 3 or 4 years, 10 years, 15, and 20 years from now when I have 3 hearing aids on my head, don't come up to me and say, Dr. Fox, we trained our employees, and now they're all perfect, and everything's wonderful, because it's never going to be wonderful. People always need some fine tuning, right? And you can't be sure that things aren't going to change. So be aware of all that. And there's one more thing that we need to elaborate on much more fully, and it's just write this in your notes. N-E-C-G-D. Just write that in there. And if you can figure out what it means, then we'll have something to start our conversation with on a Tuesday.